Hi everybody, welcome to the last Media Voices episode of this year. After this episode, we are going on a Christmas break, which Esther, well deserved.
Oh my word, I'm literally crawling to next week, guys.
Before that, we do have to get through this week's news, so I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
And I'm Esther Thorpe. So this week I spoke to Richard Reeves. He's the Managing Director at the UK's Association of Online Publishers. So we talked about the progress they've made on getting publishers to agree on an ad quality charter. We talked a bit about how Facebook and Google engage with their member publishers, and also what he makes of Jonah Peretti's suggestion for a mega merger of online publishers to tackle the duopoly.
Yeah, that one's really interesting. I saw that mooted and I have thoughts and feelings on it, but we might have to save that for a special. Or maybe this week, because as he mentioned in the notes, it's actually been a very slow news week. Media seems to be gearing down ahead of Christmas.
There's a surprise.
Yeah, I know. So the first thing on the agenda is Google is launching a voice-driven version of Google News for smart speakers and phones. Why don't you take us through this one?
So there was some Reuters research that came out that suggested that actually news briefings from publishers haven't proved massively popular for consumers. I can hear listeners already being like, I listen to news briefings. Well, jolly good, you're not like a normal consumer. So Google has kind of looked to address some of these concerns by delivering what they've called personalised audio news feeds through Google Assistant, according to Neiman Lab.
I feel like they just picked words out of a hat to create that sentence, you know. Personalised, yes, audio, yes.
News feed, yes. But the good thing is they've worked on this initiative with about 130 other publishers, so it's not just them sitting in a box. And from what I could gather about this, it seems to be like an audio version of personalised news aggregation, which seems to be a really sensible thing.
Yeah.
Oh, Chris, you've got a smart speaker. Is this just like really obvious?
The thing is that a lot of the people who actually put out smart speakers made news almost an afterthought. You know, as much as we like to think about news in, you know, different forms, different contexts, if you look at that Reuters research, only 1% of people who use their smart speaker do so for news, and an even smaller percentage of that actually do so on a regular basis.
I think do people use them for?
Well, it's 67% or maybe 61% use it for music, so just to kind of change tracks and stuff, which is functional and it's very useful, and I use it for that. And if you look at the adverts around this and all the marketing, you know, Google marketed it, Amazon marketed Alexa on the base of being able to do these things. And, you know, the same is true for podcasts. I think it's only about, you know, 25% of people use it for podcasts. And so news as a product doesn't really exist as it should there. You're right that this sounds like it's something that should already exist on there.
But this is where I lose it a little bit with smart speakers. I don't have one. So, again, I'm not really sure of the behaviours around it. But if you think, OK, I want to catch up on the news in the morning, and you sit down on the settee, are you going to go to your smart speaker or are you just going to switch on the TV?
Well, this is it. They're trying to create a new behaviour, effectively. You know, it's very easy to say, oh, people already listen to the radio, but they don't do it in the same way that you, you know, choose to consume content on these smart speakers. And crucially, the kind of the early entrants into that space were very much, you know, MVP, minimum viable product. I don't think I ever listened to any news on there that made me go, I could only have listened to it and got this out of it from the fact it's on a smart speaker.
And from what Google has said about this, it's less like you're not going to get a bundled briefing from a publisher who's decided to bundle this stuff together. It's more, as you would read on Google News, there'll be like a story from The Independent, there'll be a story from The Guardian, and they'll kind of mix all this stuff together. My question there is, will there actually be enough in that audio to differentiate publishers? You know, you've not got the logo, you've not kind of got that visual cue that it's from a specific publisher. So are you going to remember where a story's come from?
Well, that's already a problem on there. I think only 25% of people can remember, you know, where the news briefing they got came from. And, you know, that's actually a good stat compared to social, as the Reuters report makes clear, which is about 50% of people cannot remember the brand they got the news from. Still not a good number. To be fair, that doesn't mitigate a lot of the other problems that people have with this. So from the report, again, people were saying that they don't feel like it's updated, you know, as quickly, as readily as it should be. And any attempt to make it more easily identifiable is going to require more effort. It's bizarre, I think, that people aren't putting more resources into this, considering that all the stats show that penetration of smart speakers is actually on the increase. It's definitely there's definitely a market there if you do it right. And I just don't think anybody's doing it right yet.
Which is why I think actually Google's been quite smart, because this kind of what they've called a voice-driven version of Google News is launching not just on smart speakers, but it's launching on phones as well. Mm. And I think that's the thing, is that if you want to transition people, the phone is quite a good place to start. If they can get this audio brief on their phone alongside their morning podcast, they then might kind of think, oh, actually, if I can get that while I'm waking up on my smart speaker, it's smooths that journey a little bit more rather than just expecting a completely brand new behavior.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, it's in Google's best interest. I think Google are the ones who are going to make this work because they're not like Alexa. They're not trying to hawk products using it. Google is effectively, you know, their product is search and search results. So it makes sense that they would be the ones to do this right.
The biggest question I have here is if there's a story from The Independent, a story from The Guardian, and an advert in between, who gets the revenue?
Well, exactly. And also the fact that if there's a story from The Guardian and a story from The Independent, you have to be very clever about how you do that, because a lot of the time that content's going to be duplicated. So even if you are aggregating all these news sources, you know, who gets top billing effectively for a piece of news that everybody else is going to run as well?
Ugh.
Yeah, I'm sure that this time next year we will be able to look back and go, you know what, they actually made some strides with that.
So I think another one of our predictions from ages ago, when YouTube Red launched, we were quite skeptical about it, weren't we, thinking back? Well, it hasn't panned out. So YouTube's gamble that its core young audience will pay $9.99 a month to see original movies and series starring YouTube creators they could already watch for free, funnily enough, didn't work out.
Yeah, it's bizarre, this one. It's really strange. And you know, obviously, this is immediately being compared to what Netflix is doing, you know, because they were a premium video service. And it's so bizarre that they, you know, that pricing put them in that range, considering that a lot of the stuff that was generated, like you said, already existed there for free, and also just had no wider market appeal. Like, I don't give a shit about what some of these YouTube creators are doing behind the paywall, and I watch YouTube all the time. So it's bizarre to think that, you know, the wider market would ever have gone, you know what, I need to see what Dan TDM or PewDiePie are doing for YouTube Red. It just seems like a completely bizarre execution of this idea.
It's very, very strange. So they're sort of not officially said that they're canning it, but the service seems to be kind of being quietly phased out. A lot of the originals that were in production originally for YouTube Red are now being made available to the whole YouTube audience, just ad-supported, which is basically, YouTube, yeah, I'm not doing it anymore.
Yeah.
But if I said to you 3.5 million subscribers, that doesn't sound like 3.5 million subscribers at $10 a month. It isn't
That's
bad going.
Bad.
When you compare it to Netflix and Amazon, who have 120 odd million each. And also, I think like YouTube's audience, I think this is something people forget, YouTube has an audience of over 2 billion people a month. So 3.5 million subscribers is pitiful when you compare that.
It's bizarre. And it's even more bizarre when you compare it to, say, what? Yeah, not a competitor, but one of its rivals, say, what Twitch are doing, which let you subscribe to individual channels. You don't have to pay for this kind of aggregated, you know, video bundle when you can just go down the niche route and only pay who you want to support. You know, it was Too Long for Dick and Too Short for Richard. It wasn't competing with Netflix because it didn't have the content there, it didn't have the investment, but it wasn't competing with Twitch. It wasn't granular enough.
I think it's the wrong strategy for the wrong brand. Like you said, if they'd adopted a Twitch-style model, that suits the audience, it suits the creators. This was just pitched completely wrong. And it was pitched in this podcast's lifetime. I can remember discussing its launch. But this isn't the weirdest thing about YouTube this week. YouTube also... I can't believe I'm announcing a different brand doing this every week. YouTube are offering stories of disappearing videos to their creators, which will last 7 days and only be made available in the mobile app. I feel so old.
Yeah. Yeah, LinkedIn launch stories, now YouTube launching stories. What is it about the appeal of ephemeral content that makes everyone want to get on board?
I don't know. I don't know who's... is this just something like under 25s get? Because literally, again, this is launched on Facebook. No, none of my Facebook friends are using it.
No.
I know some Instagram friends are using it, but I don't really tend to check them. Don't get it. Yeah. Okay. So if anybody gets stories, I'm more than happy to be disagreed on that. And if you think YouTube launching them is a great idea, great. Tweet us.
Mind you, oh God, that is the perfect segue. So talking about monetizing video on Twitter, Reuters is seeing a bit of a revenue bump from monetized video on Twitter. So, you know, videos monetized through pre-roll, mid-roll, sponsorship placements, and their executive editor says that Twitter now brings in significant revenue in line with what the company gets from Google AMP. So that's kind of cool, right? Because this is what Twitter's been making a play towards for quite some time. You know, when we spoke to Bruce Daisley, he foresaw this as being a major part of their revenue model.
Yeah, and we did talk a little bit about this, shameless plug here, we did talk a little bit about this in our Media Moments report, which you can download from the website.
Always be closing.
And I think Twitter have kind of done what Facebook always promised to do but never got round to, which is actually put pre-roll, mid-roll and sponsorship placements in videos. Mm. But I think the thing with the thing with Reuters here, you know, it's great that they're making this revenue, but most of the revenue is coming through their kind of their top news account, which has 20 million followers. So is this actually a sustainable strategy for a smaller account?
How replicable is this for people who aren't Reuters and, you know, similar news wires?
And the other place are actually growing quite quickly. So they've started putting out videos in Japanese and Spanish. And actually the appetite for video in Japan is really quite high. So they've said actually that's quite a good opportunity we've just spotted just through experimenting with this. But they're also looking to cut 12% of their workforce by 2020. So yeah, maybe they need a bit more Twitter revenue before they can not cut that.
I love it, a zinger right at the end.
Yeah, I mean, obviously people losing their jobs is never good, but to have those two stories out in the same week was a bit like, okay.
Yeah, it was actually a really good week to bury news, so...
Well, because nobody's winning the office.
Nobody's giving. Yeah, nobody cares anymore. Everybody's at Christmas shopping. And then, just as a final piece of news, The Correspondent, so which is the English language version of The Correspondent, which has always been one of our crushes on Media Voices, only has 4 days to find £600,000. So its crowdfunding had a target of £1.9 million, or I think it was $2.5 million, and it has, you know, high profile support from everybody from Russ Bridger, Jimmy Wales, Jay Rose, and many more to quote. Unbreak the news. So their message is, what fast food is to the body, news is to the mind, which anybody who's been online can surely identify with. So yeah, we just want to give them a shout. Go to The Correspondent and feel like kicking in a couple of quid, go for it.
And we're now able to offer transcripts of our interviews thanks to our partnership with Trint. They have a really cool AI automated transcription tool. I'm going to trip up on that 1 week for audio and video. So keep an eye out for more details both about them and the transcripts in our weekly newsletter. And we have an exclusive email list to receive the transcripts as soon as they go live on a Monday. Okay, so this week I spoke to Richard Reeves, who heads up the Association of Online Publishers in the UK. So I started by asking him about their recent annual conference and what lessons had come out of it that publishers could take into next year.
One of the things that we're you know, which was probably a theme of the event without it intending to be so, is that, you know, we've seen a continued onslaught on premium content creators' ability to be able to monetize their content through advertising. And a reality is that no matter what else we do and how we diversify, a base level of advertising is essential to the sustainability of our businesses. So there was a lot of discussion around not just the advertising model as it exists now, and if you like, the calls for greater accountability and evenness and fairness in the process, but there was also a phenomenal amount of insight shared by publishers and other organisations around areas where they have succeeded through diversification. So we looked specifically around paid content models and the development of growth around there. We also talked about, you know, the challenges around innovating businesses that you find internally in terms of how you bring all the stakeholders, commercial people, editorial people, operational people, all together. So, you know, we reflected about everything that is publishing. We heard and debated perspectives from other contributors in the industry. But ostensibly, I think we were focused on what actions need to be undertaken, not by just by individual publishers, but us as trade body representatives, to ensure that there is the ability to be able to move forward and continue to sustain what we do, but also to look at where perhaps we're going wrong. And I don't just mean publishers, but collectively. I mean, again, one of the points I raised in my opening notes that also became, or comments that became a theme, the concerns that we have around our greatest asset, which is the consumer, and how certain advertising practices are potentially undermining that relationship and the trust. And I suppose the biggest foghorn I certainly sounded, that I certainly wanted everyone to have as a takeaway, which is that, you know, we need to check our behaviour, we need to think about what we do, and we need to encourage advertisers not just to make pledges about changing behaviour, but for them to actually fulfil those pledges. If we're successful in finding ways of diversifying our revenue streams to not include advertising, then not only have advertisers perhaps lost in an online environment the attention of the user, I would suggest a very valuable environment for those advertising messages to live might have been lost too. Premium content creators are more than just advertising environments. An increasing amount of evidence to demonstrate that if you provide quality content, people are willing to pay for it. And therefore, that takes the relationship and the exchange of the value of that content direct between the provider of that content and the consumer. And it may be that contractually, those positions are such where both parties are satisfied that the commercial messages don't need to live in that environment. And I think that that's... it's not something that people should be too flippant about.
And whether that's sustainable for all businesses as well. It's the argument if all the paywalls go up, you'll end up losing revenue because people won't pay for everything they read.
Well, that's true. But one of the things that, I'm in my 50s, so I've been in this industry since 84. And one of the things when you conceive an idea for a print product or a broadcast product or a radio product of any kind, when you conceive those ideas, you don't think that you have a God-given right to succeed. You work very hard to identify the audience and the opportunity, and then you go to market. And I've been around enough, with interest, watched somebody identify a new vertical or a new niche, and then suddenly watched how the market floods it. For about 3 months, typically you have one out there that's taking the lead, and everyone looks to it and goes, gosh, this is a space that could be generating money and perhaps we should be in it. Suddenly everyone floods that market, then there's a natural consolidation. You go from one to about 100 players, back down to about three or four market leaders. But because of what technology enables in an online era, there is no barrier to entry. And this is part of the problem with a strategy.
Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it depends who you are and how you want to look at it. But I think it's a great thing. But I do think that, and this is obviously one of the things that we do as a trade body for premium content providers, is that you have to be clear about differentiating the media environment, its audiences, and the quality within that. And that's not to suggest that there aren't bloggers out there that provide great quality, meaningful audiences and reach to key demographics. They do. But there are also so many other things that in this online era seem to be forgotten, that to be the curator of original content, you are effectively a subscriber to principles, clear, defined principles. So, and again, none of that's a problem. No one has an issue. But when advertising and the purchase behavior of advertising moves to a point, as it has, where you forget those differentiators and you treat it all as the same and commoditize it, then naturally, why would an advertiser be surprised if they're buying effectively blind through an open exchange programmatically, that they've got ad messages appearing in environments that they're not entirely comfortable with? They don't have those controls and the parameters, and I think it's important that we recognise that. But, going back to your point, I'm pleased there's no barrier to entry, but I do also think that anybody needs to recognise that you don't have a God-given right to exist. So, to your point, if everything lives behind a paywall, then there is no doubt that some will survive better than others, because, of course, you have to produce quality and there has to be demand in order for people to want to pay for it.
And when it comes to advertising, the AOP have worked on the Ad Quality Charter, which yes. I think came out just over a year ago now.
Yeah, we launched this at the previous summit in October of 2017,
How did you get everybody to kind of agree on what these universal metrics and standards would be?
Well, I mean, the base level was the fact that all of us are, in one way or another, and AOP in particular, we're one of the four stakeholders of JICWebs, the Joint Industry Committee for Web Standards. So in one way or another, everybody is contributing to the desire of our industry collectively to have a set of clear standards. But one of the very interesting things is that as a contributor to that process, you know, it's easily recognisable and undisputable, really, that media owners who create original content, who live online, have in place long established codes of practice and principles that they have simply adopted into an online era. So the Ad Quality Charter, if you like, took the industry standard as its principal base to inform the structure of the document and of the charter, and then from within that, through discussion with the publishers and through research, we're able to identify what is a comfortable level that we're operating at or beyond that standard. So part of the purpose of the Ad Quality Charter, if you like, was to enable a vehicle by which we can more clearly differentiate and also offer safeguards, a declaration of assurances and safeguards to quality advertisers that value that, and to be able to therefore demonstrate why a premium environment can justifiably command a premium CPM. So a lot of it is about using a quality charter and our members to help encourage the floor to raise across the industry, but also to support our publishers in a key aspect that we feel is vital part of the advertising buying process, which is to recognize the superior environment and to have that clearly differentiated. And one of the ways that the charter allows us to do that is on inspection of where risk lies. So if we talk about fraud, for example, and then you look at the processes that content creators, premium media owners, have in place to address fraud and how they negate that, you can see that in real terms it's a negligible amount. So as premium content providers, we are able to make a guarantee through a charter that we would make that guarantee to advertisers that they would effectively not be paying for any fraud. It would be zero fraud. So it's about, you know, moving those goalposts, or rather raising the floor and moving the parameters so that it is easier for advertisers and the agencies that plan and buy on their behalf to differentiate quality.
And are you happy with its progress a year on?
It's interesting. I'm kind of pleased you asked that, actually, because it's a living document that's really not transformed greatly in the 12 months.
Okay.
And the reason being is that what the document also enabled us to do and has set out is an understanding. So if I take another one of the hygiene metrics that's applied by the industry around viewability, separate from viewability anyway, publishers will have a view that some of the performance metrics that advertisers are expecting us to adhere to, these hygiene factors, are perhaps sometimes being viewed the wrong way.
Yes.
In other words, you know, are we actually really looking at in view, or are we, what is viewability? Is it the opportunity to see? And how does that translate in terms of the transparency and accountability already exists in digital? You know, do you ask the same of broadcast? Do you ask the same of print? How can you guarantee that that ad's actually being seen? You know, so it's also recognizing that we need to continue to have discussions about what we actually mean when we say viewability. So that's one side of things. But within the charter, when we created it, we were purposefully ambiguous around viewability, because it gave me an opportunity to effectively make a statement saying that whilst there is increasing demand from buy side to be able to apply viewability as a guarantee metric in purchase, what we need to understand first and foremost is if we're going to have that dialogue, that we need to correct some of the misapplication that exists in the fulfillment and the placement of advertising. So by that I mean that we have two areas which are out of the charter, but are very much campaigns and key initiatives that we continue to drive. And then there's the other aspect that as an industry we've supposedly come together over many occasions and often driven by the IAB. The reality is that, you know, we don't, as you do in other media, have any form of flight check process. Nobody seems to be particularly fazed or fussed about compliance. And again, one of the impacts with any viewability metric can potentially be latency around ad delivery. And that latency around ad delivery can often be caused, in fact, based on the research we're currently doing, around 80% of the time it's caused because the file size submitted is non-compliant. So if you look at it from a publisher's point of view, ads that are being supposedly delivered programmatically that may fail the keyword block list application, or if they succeed and pass through that, then fail because they are non-compliant in terms of their file size, and therefore that user has since moved on from the ad call, gone to another page, and ad hasn't been delivered. You add that all up and that's around 20-30% further impact, negative impact on publisher revenues. So the ad quality charter for us was putting a line in the sand. It was a declaration, it was a statement of intent saying these are all the things that we will be able to guarantee you, that no other environment online, no other media organization, including Facebook and Google, are able to offer, to provide us guarantees. And it is our desire to get to a point that we are all operating around those guarantees.
And you've also recently announced a partnership with the Media Trust UK.
Yes.
And that's, I think it's providing members with a centralised pool of verified cookie data. Mm. Now, could you talk us through what that partnership involves and why it's necessary?
Yeah, I mean, the Media Trust has sort of had an indirect partnership with the AIP for a couple of years. We had decided, really off the back of all of our GDPR work, that it was an acknowledgement, actually, that bizarrely we've got to us as publishers or media owners, we got to a stage where around the insertion order, the advertising transaction between agency and publisher online, all the declarations, the DPAs, were driven from the buy side. And when it was very clear what the expectations are of the law in terms of compliance, in the context of both GDPR and the e-privacy directive, we felt it was important to create a protocol that is in many ways an insurance statement for media owners that effectively says to any body that wishes to transact within their environment or place an advertising message, that they acknowledge that the only pixels that can be embedded in that ad are for specific purposes such as ad verification. So, as we know, there are many, many vendors and many other vendor parties that are part of the daisy chain that are perhaps hidden, who are processors. So we needed to identify a way that we could distribute that product protocol to all vendors. There is no plan at the moment for some form of rigorous enforcement. It's simply, again, like I say, an insurance policy that publishers, through a single login to a platform that we've created with Media Trust, will be able to identify those that have demonstrated a willingness to sign this or not. The Media Trust pit that has now gone live and is really at the stage of a vendor outreach is about contacting any vendor that we, through Media Trust, have identified as currently running any kind of cookie across any AIP member site. And then shortly there will be an outreach to the publishers that will provide them with a single login that they are then able to go in and look up any vendor, any cookie, and from that to be able to identify whether there is clear declaration, whether there isn't, and so forth. And then the third phase beyond that is then to specifically use the protocol in the same way, vendor outreach, will you, won't you, do you, don't you accept, and then again through that single login for publishers to see where they are.
And Facebook are associate members of yours. Do you find them... I notice Google often gets quite involved in a lot of the conferences and things you do. Do you find Facebook at all proactive in wanting to perhaps tackle some of the issues that members have had with them over the last couple of years?
I do see them as two very different organisations. I do see Google, in part, playing an essential role in providing tools that enable publishers to do what they do. But I have to say that we have, within the organisation, we operate a number of steering groups. And the steering groups are essential to AIP. They effectively provide our mandate and they provide us with the insight that helps us understand and occasionally feel the pain that our members undergo. But a very important part and part of what we discussed at the summit and part of what we discuss at every meeting and everything. What I do know is that they offer phenomenal scale reach to individuals, and that in order to exist online in this world, you need a platform strategy. You need a strategy that enables you to be discovered by new audiences and to be able to attract people into your content. So both Google and Facebook have strategies around that and publisher strategies enabling that discovery of content. And we run a product and audience development groups that when we launched them about 2.5 years ago, part of the challenge and what was clearly obvious in every discussion, you know, someone would pipe up and say, does anyone know how to work with AMP or get the best out of it? What's happening on instant articles? Is anyone being affected by these algorithms? Endless amount of questions. And so we reached out to both Facebook and Google and said, look, you know, there's something over and above what we all do together that needs addressing. We have an appetite for confidential meetings with you and your engineers so that we can better understand those tools and that will then inform our application and use of those. And so, you know, we've had them in, you know, as we do all vendors that have something that's pertinent to the dialogue at that time. We've had them in presenting as steering groups and things. But this year we created something that we've continued to follow through, which was twice annually. We have a love-in with Facebook and Google and the product and the audience development groups. The first of which we ran in February, which was hosted by Google. And then Facebook also came to the Google offices to participate in that. So we basically ran two consecutive sessions, one with Google, one with Facebook, governed by Chatham House and an element of confidentiality, of course, where we were able to put most of those challenges, concerns, questions, and also received and continue to receive information, if you like, ahead of the curve back from them. What we don't suggest to any publisher is that they get themselves in a situation where they have a dependency on one. And I think that largely the people that we deal with within all of these organizations have an acute understanding of what is required and what is involved.
And when it comes to campaigns and initiatives, what are some of your priorities for next year?
It's the air quality brand safety piece that we were talking about. It's surfacing the evidence to affect a change of behaviour around keyword blocking applications, about compliance to creatives. It's looking at flight checkers. It's establishing the protocol. It's working with the likes of the IB and our other industry partners, IPN, ISBA, to address transparency and to, again, provide body of evidence that encourages everyone to recognise the needs to prioritise ways of addressing that. But equally, you know, there is research that we're doing around proving the quality of premium to enable, again, clearer understanding of the need to differentiate that not all environments are equal and so forth. But also in particular, looking at paid content models, diversification away from advertising, and and those that work and don't, continuing to strengthen our relationships and knowledge with platforms, so that where we do have an off-platform strategy or that we use social media, we, you know, we're better and more informed of how we leverage that. But also, and I think this is really genuinely important, because it's a very hard thing for anyone to understand, even came across, which is journalism and protecting that in the future. It breaks my heart when you read what's happening within local press and media and the challenges they're facing over at Johnston Press and the like at the moment. And if we don't work better as an industry to identify and provide ways to better protect the future of quality independent journalism, then it will be a very dark day. So I think, as well as addressing the immediate priorities, we have an absolute desire and focus next year into understanding more about how we can contribute to the knowledge and understanding of what needs to be done in order to protect journalism for the future.
And I don't know if you saw Jonah Peretti's New York Times interview last week, the BuzzFeed CEO. He did an interview where he suggested that maybe the way forward was to combine Vice, Fox, or a lot of the big digital publishers to take on the job. But he said actually maybe as one big conglomerate would be better placed. What do you make of that?
Well, that's great. I'll tell you what, let's have a marketplace where we have just Facebook, Google, Bauer with everybody else under there, and maybe, you know, I mean, ridiculous. But not so ridiculous in the context of even before online, the ability to have an independent expression and tone and personality that somebody can find an affinity to, and that's important. Now, if someone can show me a really good way under a big, you know, and there are big media owner organisations that do it reasonably well, but, you know, if you have all of the diverse brands under one umbrella, you know, can you assure me that culturally they'll remain independent? That's one thing. But aside from that, where I think, you know, there is some truth in that comment is that I think that, you know, unless we are able to affect change in some of the ways that are about those injustices, how can an organisation like Facebook be such a beneficiary of the media ecosystem but not be able to not define itself as a media company and therefore not have to fulfill any of the obligations that media companies do? Those are injustices. Now, if that behavior continues and that continues to put a threat upon the existence of independent media owner organizations, then naturally the only way for some of those to survive will be to consolidate. And I think that's a very, very sad time. But if we get to that, but I'm hoping, because I'm an optimist, that we continue to smash heads together and encourage people to see reason over anything else, to get ourselves into a point where there are not legislation, because I don't think any government's going to do that. They've had enough time as it is to affect change and provide influence, and they've never done so. So I think that as an industry, keep educating ourselves and look at the writing on the wall and recognise what needs to be done to protect that. And of course, if people don't value it and they don't protect it, then so be it. That's change, that's transformation. But optimistically, I think that the debates have sufficed to suggest that there is enough energy and enthusiasm around those tables to ensure that we don't get to a point where we all consolidate into two great
publishing lumps.
Exactly.
So the last thing we ask all our guests is what the last thing is you saw or read that really affected you?
I really don't like reading what I read about what's happening in local media and Johnston Press. That's something that I think is should be a wake-up call to all of us, to recognise that everyone's vulnerable and we need to change the way we think. So in that context, I would say reading about the woes, I think, is probably the best word that are currently being experienced both within local media and at Johnston Press.
So as mentioned previously, we do have a weekly newsletter which goes out every single week and contains a curated list of all the fantastic pieces of news we found that we want to share with you, in addition to some exclusive content, a sort of mini article, fair to say?
Yeah,
mini article, and links out to the stuff that we have been reading and writing over that week.
And we've plugged it for the last couple of weeks, so we'll plug it again. And we have written our very first end of year report, Media Moments 2018, takes a look at most of the stuff we discuss on the podcast. It's really good. It's kind of like article form, so it's down into bite-sized chunks depending on what you're interested in. So you can download that on the website, and we'll keep plugging that until the end of the year.
And even though we will be gone from your podcast feed for a couple of weeks, you can follow us on social to keep abreast of everything that we're up to and links out to everything that we find particularly interesting. So I'm on Twitter at Chris M. Sutcliffe.
I'm at Esther Keziah Thorpe. And as we said, this is the last episode of the year, but we are working on some new bits over Christmas, including our guest lineup for next year. So if you have suggestions of guests you'd like to see, or even preferably nice feedback on the podcast itself, you can get hold of us. I'm Esther at voices.media.
And I'm Chris at voices.media. So until next year, when we're going to be back with another fantastic slate of guests and a whole new season of the show, thank you very much for listening and Merry Christmas.
Can you please put jingle bells on there?
I'm gonna.